Over to you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be with all of you. Not too far down the coast. Good to be in the same state, at least. And I commend you for having this conversation about a topic that's not always easy to talk about, but is incredibly important. And our plan is to do a three-part session. So we are going to conclude these three-part sessions with you having filled out legally binding, Jewishly, appropriate advance directive. But we thought it would be great to build up to that so that we'll have first a session kind of generally about Jewish values and end-of-life decision-making. Then for the next session, to get a little bit more specific in some of the specific areas that arise frequently when it comes to Jewish values and end-of-life decision-making. And then for the final session, we will actually walk through doing the advance directive. We'll send it out in advance, and we'll walk through it together, and you can leave that session with a valid advance directive. Everyone should have an advance directive, and even if you already do have one, this one, I think, as you'll see, is one that we're really proud of. That is when we worked really hard on to kind of come up with something that's both articulates some of the specific needs that arise nowadays in end-of-life care, helps people have very crucial conversations, and also is a Jewish document. So it's specially formulated for people who are Jewish to fill out. So we'll work our way up to that. And so for today's session, to start out with the conversation about kind of starting most broad, most general, as we'll kind of make our way towards the specific workshop where we'll fill out advanced directives, I wanted to talk today about general values in, when it comes to the value of life in Judaism, and to really talk about some specific nuances within that conversation that can help us as we're going to start moving our way towards actually filling out this document. And that we'll start with, there is a disagreement, because if I'd ask someone, and by the way, please feel free to either chat or raise your hand or talk, we want this to be, and I'll make sure to leave time at the end as well for questions and comments and feedback. If I was to ask you, what does Judaism say is the value of life? What's the value of life in Judaism? People often will say things like, infinite value of life, or, we value life. Like, what does it mean? Like, how do we actually articulate the value of life in Judaism? And there's really two schools of thought, which in some ways are opposing and are different, but I'll show how actually they overlap and can kind of help us to articulate one specific school of thought. But the two schools of thought are as follows. One of them, which I guess could be considered to be one extreme, are those who would say that life is of infinite value. We do everything we can, no matter what, at all costs, to prolong life. This, some will say, is based on the verse in the Torah, in Vayikra, in Leviticus, where it says, "Ushmartem es chukosai v'smishpotai, you should guard my laws, asher yaseh otam adam v'chai behem, because you should live by them, ani Hashem." The Torah says, you should live by the Torah. So based on that verse where it says you have to do whatever you can to live by the Torah, some will argue that, yeah, that means life is of the ultimate supreme value. And in fact, the Talmud does seem to support that view. The Talmud in Yoma, Pehei, where it says as follows, the Talmud says, what do you do, Misha Nafalav Mapolas, if a wall or a building falls on someone on Shabbat? And imagine that, it falls in a way that it would be forbidden by the rules of Shabbos to unearth the person. But can you break Shabbos to save a life? What do you think? Are you allowed to break Shabbos? Yes, I see you nodding your heads. Yes, you, of course. What if you're not sure someone's there? It's a suffik, b'koach nefesh. Maybe someone's there, maybe they're not there. Can we still break Shabbos to save a life, even if we're not sure we will be saving a life? Yes, good. Then we also, if whether someone's there, whether we're not sure they're there, if there's any chance of saving a life, we do everything we can at all costs to save life. And that, in fact, the Mishnah Berurah quotes this, and I find this to be a very inspiring perspective, because when the Mishnah Berurah and the Bir Halacha quotes this, he says, based on this, you can see that it doesn't matter what a person contributes to society. We don't make determinations about the worth of any life. We say all human life is of infinite value. All people have infinite value of life. We should do everything we can, no matter what, whether they are elderly, a baby, you know, they're not able to talk or communicate with people. It doesn't matter. All human life is of equal and infinite value, and therefore we should save all life. And based on that source, those sources, that perspective, is the argument that life is of infinite value, and we do everything we can. So I'll tell you a story that kind of expresses that value. I remember one time I was I got a phone call, and the call went as follows. I answer my phone, and the woman on the other end says to me, right when I answer the phone, she says, "Rabbi, I don't know if you remember me. You performed my father's funeral, and now I need you to perform my son's funeral." So obviously, a very tragic way to begin a phone call. And so I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. Tell me what's going on. What happened?" So she says to me, her son, who was 18 years old, she says he had a brain aneurysm, a brain bleed, and he just collapsed. They brought him to the hospital. It wasn't my hospital here that I work at, Cedars-Sinai. It was another hospital in LA. She says he collapsed, and they tell me in here, we're here in the hospital. He's now, you know, we got through the emergency room. He's in a room now, but they tell me the brain bleed is just devastating. They don't think he can recover from that, and we should just let him go. You know, he was currently intubated. He had a breathing tube. So she said, "Well, I have to ask my rabbi. I can't do that without asking a rabbi first." So she says, "So Rabbi, I'm calling you." So I said, "Oh, wow, when did this happen? When did he collapse?" She says, "Yesterday." I said, "Yesterday? And they're already, you know, forcing you to make this decision?" She said, "Well, they're not forcing me. They said it could take some time, but like, why would you want your son to suffer that way?" This is what the doctor said to me. "So what? So why, you know, why do we want to do this?" So, you know, when I heard that, and we'll talk about this more specifically next week when we go into the more specific details of Jewish law and end-of-life decision-making, medical Jewish medical ethics. But I felt like, based on Jewish law, this is not so easy. This is going to be a little bit of a challenge. Like, you can't just take someone off of a ventilator if they're going to die right away as a result. I mean, there are sometimes strategies, and we'll talk about them. There are ways that it can be done, but we take that decision very seriously. So I said, you know, it's only been one day. Maybe you can get a second opinion. Maybe we can look into it a little bit more. Let's just be sure before we move so quickly on this. She says, "Okay, I'll call you back." The next day, she calls me back. She says, "Rabbi, it didn't get any better. I think this is cruel. Why are we prolonging his death? Let's just let him go. But I can't do it without you saying that it's okay, because I'll feel guilty." So I said, "So you got a second opinion?" She says, "No, I didn't get a second opinion, but it's still, now it's 48 hours and there's no recovery." So I said, "You know, let me ask also some specialists and really try to get a second opinion. It's Friday now. Let's give it the weekend. Call me Monday and let's discuss then." She says, "Okay, fine." All weekend, I was like, what am I going to say? I'm not sure. I feel bad for her on the one hand, but on the other hand, I don't know that we can just allow this, because Jewish values in medical ethics do encourage trying to prolong life when possible, as we just read, v'chai behem. But of course, I want to have compassion for those who are suffering. So I don't know what to do. And I asked a few people, they didn't know. So I said, "Well, let me see what happens." She calls me Monday with an update. So Monday came and went, no call. Tuesday, no phone call. Wednesday, no phone call. Thursday night, I was at an event. And at this event, this rabbi comes over to me and he says, "Oh, you're the rabbi at Cedars-Sinai, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Oh, wow. What a situation that was at that other hospital." You know, I won't say it, just to keep some anonymity. I won't say. She said, "You know, what a situation that was." I said, "How did you know about that?" And they said, "Oh, you know, the mother of the patient called me over the weekend. I guess now I realize they probably didn't call you back." I said, "No, they didn't." They said, "Well, they called me on the weekend." She said, "You know, that rabbi at Cedars-Sinai, he's just a little too orthodox, a little too strict." And I'm not saying this to belittle anyone, God forbid. I'm just saying that was what they said. "He's too strict. He won't allow it. He's not allowing us to take out the tube. Would you allow it?" They asked this other rabbi, and that rabbi said, "Yeah, you know, I understand the situation. Sounds horrible. Yes, it would be allowed." So I decided. So I told the hospital, It's allowed. You know, we change our mind. We do want to allow it. But by the time, you know, it was on the weekend, things moved slower. By the time they actually got around to telling someone, and that some person was a resident, so they needed to tell their attending, it was already Wednesday. Wednesday, though, when they came to confirm with her that this is what she, in fact, wanted, they did start noticing that some of the vitals had improved. She said, really? And they said, yeah, but, you know, this sometimes happens. They said, well, maybe we should ask someone else. Now I'm rethinking it. To make a long story short, by Thursday morning, this patient had begun responding to stimuli. By Thursday afternoon, he woke up. And to make a long story short, literally where I'm sitting right now, 3 months later, this patient and his mother walked into my office and she says, I want you to meet the patient whose life you saved. Now, I immediately responded to her, I didn't save his life. I'm not telling you a story to take credit for it. I said, I didn't save his life. Halacha saved his life, meaning you called the rabbi and said what to do. And the halacha was, it was not right in that situation to withdraw the ventilator. And that was why you didn't. And that's why he's still alive. So I'm just telling that story. It's an extreme story. And I'm going to share the opposite extreme with you in a second. But I want to share that story as a way of articulating one side of the coin. Meaning on the one side of the coin, there is this perspective whereby we say we err on the side of prolonging life. We do believe in v'chai behem. We believe in trying to prolong life, giving people every chance they can to survive and to overcome illness. And that is one valid and strongly rooted approach within Jewish bioethics, within Jewish law, that we err on the side of prolonging life. However, there is another perspective, and this is going to help me to articulate. And my goal is, just so you know, to end this session by telling you the one line that is the most important line that I share with patients very frequently, and that I want to share with you today. And yes, I could have just done that for 1 minute. We could have just said, let me tell you the one line, and we'll end this, and this will just be a 1 minute session. We could have done that, but I think it'll be more meaningful if we articulate the whole process. So now we have the first part of that line, which is that we do everything we can to prolong life. We do want to help save life whenever we can. That is an important value. However, can we say that it's indeed that Jewish values say that life is of infinite value? Because infinite value, I mean, that would say at all costs, we do everything we can to save life. Is there never any mitigating factors? Can we never consider other aspects of the equation? Or do we just say, no matter what, at all times, we have to do everything we can to prolong life? And by the way, if we said life is of infinite value, which some thinkers do use that phrase, if we said that, let's say you're talking from, like, let's say a government perspective. Would you be allowed to spend any funding on anything other than healthcare? Because if we say that it's of infinite value, that's it. Nothing's more great than infinite, right? You know, so there has to be another way of looking at it that's not infinite, because infinite is a lot. So that's a little bit extreme to say that. I'm going to show you now another perspective. Also, classic perspective within Jewish medical ethics, within Jewish law. This perspective, by the way, that I think is more firmly rooted within Jewish law, a little bit deeper within the sources. And we call this, or I call it oftentimes, that life is of relative value. Relative. What does that mean? So there's another verse in the Torah, which says as follows. Rak hishamer lecha ushmor nashecha meod. Guard your life very much. And by the way, this is the only commandment in the Torah where it says me'od. You should do it very much. You should guard your health very much. But then there's something else, another interesting word. Pen tishkach et devarim asher ro'ei necha. Lest you forget the things that you learned. In other words, lest you forget the Torah. So guard your life, guard your health. But wait a second. It's not just end within itself. There's a goal. Guard your soul, guard your life, guard your health so that you can do something else. It's something that, like, you know, we sometimes say, like, as doctors, it is our role. And I'm not a doctor, but I'm saying in healthcare providers, is what we're doing the most important thing in the world? Because sometimes you'll hear from healthcare providers like, this is the most important thing, we're saving lives. But at the end of the day, if you think about it, we're not saving lives just to be alive. We're saving lives so they can therefore have a meaningful life and do things that are meaningful to them. It's a means to an end. Healthcare is a mean to an end. So yes, save your lives so that you can do something else. People right now, there's a war going on in Israel, right? It's like, is the purpose of the war to win the war? or no, is it the purpose of the war so that people can live a good life, so that people can live in peace, right? We don't fight to win a war. You fight in order to be able to not have wars, right? In order to have peace. So too, healthcare, saving one's life, the purpose of it is to live a good life. So, but it's not just, the purpose is not being alive. The purpose is Torah, mitzvot, you know, relationships, love. There's other means of being alive, purposes of being alive. So when the Talmud said, when the Torah says, guard your life, that next word is crucial. Pen. So that you want to have good health, but it's for a cause, it's for a reason, it's for a goal. So life itself is not the infinite value. The infinite value is the Torah, is love, is relationships, right? There's a reason to be alive. And this goes to now a very important story. So I told you one story. That story was very, very relevant. But there's another one. And sometimes in the Talmud, you have contradictions. And when that happens, you have to figure out which one's the primary story and then understand the other ones in light of that story. So this story goes, and in fact, I'll read it to you just because the specific words are very crucial. And then we'll pull back for a second and analyze these two stories and analyze everything that we've said and summarize and then try to lead that towards some important, crucial messages and lessons and values. And that will help build the blocks towards the next two sessions. So the story goes as follows. There was a great, great, great rabbi. He was one of the greatest rabbis ever. I don't think they had rabbi rankings back in those days in the Talmud, but if they did, he would have been ranked in the top five for sure. Probably number one. I'm joking, but I'm also not joking because he really was an amazing rabbi, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. He was the editor of the entire Mishnah, and he was a leader. He was called Hanasi because he was a leader of the Jewish people. So Hahu Yoma Denach Nafshi the Rebbe. The day that he died, the Talmud tells the story, and the people were so upset and sad when he was dying. They needed him. They needed their rabbi. He was a great rabbi. Gazru Rabbanim Tanisa Ubar Rachme. So therefore, they were fasting and praying in the hopes that he would get better. And they even said, Koman the Amar Nachnashi the Rebbe. If anyone says that Rebbe died, if anyone says that such a thing, Yidkar Becher, let that person die, because let the person be stabbed, because we would not say, no one would say that he's dying because we can't lose him. So what they do? Slika amsid the Rebbe leigra. So the maidservant, there was a woman who lived with him. She's called, it's translated as maid, but she wasn't a maid, she was his assistant. She's quoted in the Talmud something like 10 times, her opinion in Jewish law, because she was a very wise woman and very authoritative woman, and she knew the Torah. She was a great woman, and so her actions have actually halachic standing. So she went up into the roof, and she says, Amra, El Yoni Mevakshim Es Rebbe, V'tachtoni Mevakshim Es Rebbe. She says, I realized that, that God is saying, you know, that Rebbe should come back, because he's very sick. God's summoning him back to heaven. But the people below, the students, they're also requesting Rebbe. So the people in the upper worlds, God is requesting his soul to come back, but the people on this earth want him to stay. So there's a tug of war. So she says, "He ratzon sheyachovo tachtonim asayonim." May the people below win out over God above, because we want to keep him here with us alive. But then something happened, and this is the critical word. The main word in the story is "kivan dechazai kamazimne de'ayal lebeis hakisei." But now she was a compassionate woman, and I can tell you some of the other stories if you want about her in the Talmud that shows her compassion. But she was a compassionate woman. She was there on the front lines also. The students were outside, but she was inside with him. So Kivan de Chazai, when she saw herself come as Imni de El de Beskis, he had to keep on getting up, going to the bathroom. So he wasn't relegated to his bed, by the way. He was able to get up and go to the bathroom, but he had to keep on taking off his tefillin. He was suffering, he was in a lot of pain. V'chaz tefillin u'manach l'hud u'kamet stayer. He was in a lot of pain. Amma, so she said, you know what? I changed my mind. I see that he's suffering. Prolonging life for him is not in his best interest. So she changed her prayer. She said, Amra, he ratzon sheyachofu el yoni mesatachton. No, may the upper worlds win. May God take him, because what the students are praying for is not in his best interest. Let him go. V'lo havu shat kerabanan mi leboi rachme. But the rabbis wouldn't stop praying. And their prayers were so strong and so meaningful that they were keeping him alive. His prayers actually kept his soul in his body because their prayers were that powerful. So she thought to herself, how are we going to win this? Because it's not good for him to be alive, but they won't stop praying. So she went to the roof. She took a huge earthenware jug smash it to the ground. Shukla kuza shadim igra l'ara. She threw it down to the ground. It startled them. They thought it was a bomb or something that just exploded. They didn't know what happened. So they stopped praying for just 1 second. Ishtaku mirachme. They stopped praying. V'nach nafshet the Rebbe. In that moment that they stopped praying, suddenly his soul left and he died. And you see from that story, and in fact, the rabbis, I meant to show you here, this is the Ran, the rabbis of the commentaries, the Rishonim and Achronim, the earlier rabbis, and even more recent, the Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Moshe Feinstein, they quoted the story. The Ran quotes the story as saying that it's allowed to pray for people to die. You're actually permitted by Jewish law to pray for someone to die, if that's what's in their best interest, if they're suffering, if their death is would be better than life for them, kind of like the words of Yonah, the prophet Jonah, when he said, "Tov mosi mechayai," my death would be better than my life because he was suffering so much. It's actually allowed by Jewish law to pray for someone to die rather than to live, and there can be times when that is the appropriate approach, and this comes up a lot. I remember, just to give you another illustration on this side, I remember one time there was a patient, a family who was very dedicated to Jewish law, and unfortunately the patient was really suffering and in the dying process. And we had a family meeting to explain the situation, and the team was explaining why, you know, chest compressions would not be in this patient's best interest. So they explained to them, and the family said, you know, is that mean DNR? Is that what you're saying? Do not resuscitate? And the doctor said, yes. So they said, you know, we spoke to our rabbi, and our rabbi said DNR is against Jewish law. So we can't accept that. So they said, okay, I mean, then that's, you know, we are in a stalemate. And we said, we'll respect your wishes. And they called the rabbi again. The rabbi said, yes, no, Jewish law does not allow DNR ever. So that was the plan. Then I got a call from them a few days later, asking me to come to their room urgently. Went up to the room. It was in the ICU. The ICU in our hospital, probably like most hospitals, I think, is all glass doors. And you can even see into the other rooms in the ICU, unless you pull the curtains. So they said to me, Rabbi, we want to make sure that our father is no code. So I said to them, this is a little confusing because no code means DNR. It's another way of saying it. So I said, oh, so you want DNR? They said, no, we're against DNR. Our rabbi said, we cannot have DNR. We do not want that. We just want no code, but not DNR. So I said, well, I'm a little confused now. Can you explain to me what you mean? They said, sure. We're here in our room, and we heard all of a sudden beeps, beeping, you know, bells, and we heard them go on the loudspeaker, and they said, code blue, code blue. Then we saw all of a sudden doctors and nurses and pharmacists and residents running into the room next to us. We saw people pounding on the patient's chest. We saw them putting lines in and pumping some kind of medication in. We saw them putting something over his mouth and pumping on his mouth, and they were pounding on his chest. We heard people, the doctors in the room, yelling to each other something. We saw them throwing things around. We saw blood splattering at one point. The patient was just kind of being, you know, pushed around and all this. And after a half an hour of that, all of a sudden we heard them call it. They said they called the time of death. They walked out of the room. We looked in the room. It looked like a war zone in that room. And I asked the nurse as she was walking out, what was that? She said, that was a code blue. So I said, okay, we called you, Rabbi, because we wanted to make sure that you tell them we do not want a code blue. They told us if there's no code blue, it's called no code. I said, okay, what you just witnessed was resuscitation. What no code means is DNR. They said, oh, but we can't have DNR. I said, are you sure you can't have DNR? They said, well, our rabbi said we can't have DNR. I said, well, let's call your rabbi. So we called their rabbi. Now, most rabbis are more responsible than this. So like Rabbi Cohen would not have done what I'm about to tell you the story. He would do the opposite. But this rabbi, so when I called him, I said, Rabbi, I want to talk to you about DNR. So he said, oh yeah, we're against that. I said, okay, let's talk a little more. Let me tell you, I told him the whole story that I just told you. He said to me, oh, that's what DNR stands for? I said, oh, come on. You didn't know what it meant and you told them? He said, I didn't know exactly, but I just heard it wasn't allowed. I said, he said, oh, in that case, no, I misunderstood. No, of course it's allowed. Yes, no, let me talk to the family. He told them, yeah, no, we do not require that going to all costs to prolong life. You don't have to, we don't require people to suffer in that way. So I was a little bit shocked by that story. It made me really realize we have to get the word out. But it also crystallized for me that, like, it is true that in Jewish law, we do everything we can to prolong life. At the same time, we do not prolong suffering at all costs. There are limits to that. And when in the face of severe pain and suffering, we do not say that people are required to undergo horrific pain and suffering and heroic measures at all costs to save a life that is at the end of life. So that to me illustrated, that I could tell you more stories, and I'm happy to if you want to, if we get to that, this whole concept of Hishamer lecha shmor nafshecha me'od, guard your life, pen tishkach, but for the sake of being able to live still a meaningful life. But yet when someone is suffering in the dying process, the way Rabbi Huda Anasi was, we do say there comes a point when we're allowed to allow them to die from natural causes. In fact, I prefer in the hospital, rather than using the phrase DNR, which some people think it implies giving up, because they often say, why would I not ask the doctors to resuscitate my loved one? If there's something they could do, why should they not do it? So I use the phrase more often AND. AND instead of DNR. AND stands for allow natural death. Sometimes it's appropriate to allow natural death. Not always, right? If there's something we can do and it's appropriate, we say, let's try it. That's why we did not want the patient who had a brain aneurysm, who was 18 years old and had only been 24, 48 hours. We did not want to say, you know what, just give up. Yeah, let him go. We said, let's first exhaust all possibilities. Let's try everything we can to save life. But there does come points, and I'm not going to give specifics now. We'll get a little more specific next week. There do come points where we say, this person is in the dying process. There's only so much that can be done, and they're suffering, and we don't want to prolong suffering. And so I'm going to share with you one more short source. I'm going to complete that sentence that I said before, and then I want to open it up for your comments, feedback, questions, and conversation. Because there's one more relevant source that helps me to complete the phrase that I really want to share with you today to set the framework and the foundation for our next two conversations. And this is based in the Code of Jewish Law, in the Shulchan Aruch, which says as follows. The Ramah, the Ashkenazi glosses on the Code of Jewish Law, in the Shulchan Aruch, in Yoridea Shin Lamateh, says as follows. He says, it's forbidden, asur ligrom lemeis shiyamus mehera. You cannot cause someone to die faster. We do not believe in hastening someone's death, in killing someone. Kagon, mishu gosis manaruch, v'lo yuchal liparid. Let's say someone's in the dying process for a long time. Their soul is leaving them. They're dying. But it's not leaving. They're not dying. And that's painful, right? There's suffering that happens. In fact, the rabbis say that when the soul is trying to leave, it's painful when we force it to stay in. It's actually spiritual pain. So the soul is trying to leave, but it's not. But it says, you know what? Asur lishameta karva kesem mitachtav. You cannot just pull the pillow out from underneath their head, either because that action of pulling out the pillow will kill them, or because there was some kind of segula, some kind of mystical spiritual beliefs that they had, that they believed that there was some bird feathers in the pillows that kept them alive, and by removing the bird feathers, it allows them to, or even causes them to die. Or you cannot move the patient from their space, because we believe when a person's dying, they're like a flickering flame on a candle, and by moving it, you'll cause it to go out. So you can't do things to hasten the death. You also can't put the keys to the synagogue. Some say that actually means keys to the cemetery underneath their head, because that causes them to die faster. You cannot do those things. However, but if there are things that are simply preventing the soul from leaving, meaning not that you'll do an act that will make someone die faster, but there are external barriers to their death, you can remove those barriers to allow them to die. Kagon, for example, sheyesh samuch la'oto bayis kol dofek. Like, for example, there's a sound next to the house. Kagon chotev etzim. Someone's chopping wood. And somehow either the rhythm or the noise is keeping them alive. They, like, can't fall asleep, so to speak. They can't die because of it. Oshiyesh melech al deshono, or there's salt on their tongue. And maybe the salt on their tongue is keeping their blood pressure up or whatever it is. The elum akvin itzis nefesh, and either the noise of the wood chopper or the salt on their tongue is preventing the soul from leaving, then the Ramah, the code of Jewish law, says, mutar lahasiro misham. You can remove them. De'ein b'zei ma'isek kol, because that's not an action. El shemesir hamoneah. That's hasaras hamoneah. That's what we call removing the impediment. That's allowing natural death. We are allowed to allow natural death when the soul is trying to leave, when a person is in the dying process and they're suffering. And even their suffering in this case might not even be physical suffering. It could be emotional, existential, or spiritual suffering. We can, and maybe not even can. I'll just show you one more source and then we'll discuss. It might even be that it's obligated. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, when he quotes that source, he says, Vaday de asur lasot emsain lahad the hari chayesha, we're forbidden from doing actions that prolong the dying process, both when she be serving if a person is suffering. Vistam ikuv yitzis hanefesh, even just preventing the soul from leaving, but goseis, who be serving. That's considered suffering. So the words he used was that it's forbidden to prolong the suffering of the dying process. So now it's fascinating because the first source that I shared with you seemed to imply that we do everything we can to prolong life. And we can do, and it did indeed say we can violate the laws of Shabbat to try to save life, even if it's a very long shot, that we're going to be able to save life. Because we do everything we can to prolong life. And I do believe, as I said before, that that is a beautiful value because we said it's all human life. Equally, right? We don't start choosing, oh, if it's, you know, the CEO or whatever, I don't know, you pick some important person, then we'll save them. No. We do not choose one or life over the other. All life, that's we saw that very clearly in the Mishnah Berurah. He quoted that source to say, all life is valuable, and therefore we do everything we can to save life. So that led some to say, life is of infinite value, and we do everything we can to prolong life. On the other hand, though, then we saw, on the other side, that the Torah, when it says to do everything you can to prolong life, it conditions it. It says, prolong your life so that you can live a meaningful life. And then we saw that, in fact, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the great Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, when he was suffering and sick, the woman who was his assistant who lived with him prayed for him to die. And, in fact, the rabbis then codified that and said she did the right thing. That you can actually say it, and it's when someone's suffering that we're allowed to allow them to die. So even though we do everything we can to prolong life, we do not want to prolong suffering or the dying process. When that point comes, we're allowed to favor a compassionate, palliative approach that allows people to die a natural death. That Ramah, which we'll analyze in more detail next week, but that he said we can allow natural death, right? He didn't say to kill someone or hasten their death, but he did say you can allow the dying process to ensue, and you can allow natural death. And therefore, we come to my line, that main line that I like to say. And we'll discuss a little bit more, but I also want to open up now for discussion. But that line that I say with both with patients and with families, with doctors, the summary of all of this in one sentence that helps us navigate complicated end-of-life decision-making is as follows. We do everything we can to prolong life, but we do nothing to prolong the dying process and the pain of the dying process. When that point comes, we are allowed to allow natural death. Now, when are we in the prolonging life, prolonging the dying process? That's a medical determination. So it needs partnership with the medical team, with one's self, with the patient, with their family, who can express their values, and with their rabbi. So that we can determine, on the one hand, it's totally medical to determine when we are prolonging life. But once the medical team has established that we are prolonging only suffering and the dying process, that becomes a values determination. And for that, you need the rabbi, their spiritual care providers, their family, a person's self if they've articulated that for themselves in their advanced directive, which is why by the end of this process, you will all have an advanced directive. So you'll be able to articulate what you would want, because there could be times when someone is in a dying process and they might want their life prolonged. It could be that there's an upcoming bar mitzvah or a wedding in the family, or maybe, you know what, they're okay with suffering. By the way, there's a difference between pain and suffering, which is important to point out here, right? Pain is when a person experiences physical pain. Suffering is more existential, emotional. If a person's feeling pain, but they're willing to endure that pain, that might not be suffering. They might say, you know what, I want to endure this pain. It's okay with me. I'm okay with being alive if that means still being able to be in my family's presence, or seeing someone grow up, or being able to be there for an upcoming, you know, family occasion. So that's why it becomes a values-based determination, right? So it's a partnership between the medical determination and then the values. But within Jewish law, it's important to know that there is this permission for allowing natural death to occur at a certain point, because oftentimes people, there's sometimes misperceptions within the Jewish community that we're never allowed to allow natural death to occur. And that's also not true, because that can lead to a lot of suffering, that perspective. And we can we don't have to take such an extreme approach. And even though I've seen many times rabbis take that approach, upon further conversation, they'll always then recognize that, oh yeah, no, we are allowed to allow natural death when the time comes. We don't want to prolong suffering. So there's more to say, but before I kind of conclude and summarize and get to some final points, I want to hear your perspectives and your any questions you might have, or pushback, comments. Anyone?
Like a medical definition of what are the medical considerations of when that's switching?
Yeah, that's excellent. So we have very specific. So you're saying, you know, there might be some subjectivity also in the medical determination in the first part of the phrase, but we have a definition of terminal basically in Jewish law, which is actually consistent with American law as well. So what we say is that when a person has an illness that's progressing, I mean, it's getting worse, and there's no cure for it, and their life expectancy is months, meaning not, okay, being alive is a terminal condition, which there's no cure for. So you could say everyone who's alive has a terminal condition, because right, that is the reality, right? We're all terminal. There's no cure for the mortality of being human yet. But when someone has a specific issue, that is a specific illness that is getting worse, and the best medical understanding is that it will lead to death within, let's say, 6 months is the most opinion. Some say within a year, and there's no cure for it. So that is now considered that they are in the dying process. It does not mean that we hasten death at that point. We do nothing to prolong life at that point. But now we say they're now in what's considered a chaye shah, a terminal patient. And now there's less requirement to prolong that life. And then when we get into the goses period, which is what that ramah that I mentioned was referring to, when we actually consider it painful for the soul, a goses is when they're actually in the actively dying process. And there are specific medical determinations for that as well. And major part of it is that it's irreversible, and it's they're in the process now of dying. And usually you can determine that whether it's by multisystem organ failure or difficulty breathing. There's a number of medical indications, and those are things that are not reversible. And so once you say, okay, we are in a process now that is downward spiral, there's nothing we can do about it, now we have to switch our focus. Whereas when you're talking about someone who you might say they have a horrible illness or something that's very serious, but there are ways of overcoming it, even if they might be difficult, so that's a different conversation. You know, that becomes very different if it's an illness that's reversible, that one can overcome, or that one can live for an extended period of time for, then we change the focus. But thank you for asking that. That's an important point. Others?
She was suffering terribly, and we had to fight to have the liquids removed in order to not prolong her suffering, which she never wanted and which the entire family agreed should not be prolonged. That was a very traumatic experience for me and has shaped the last, you know, decade or so of my interest in palliative care and the right to die, if one chooses that.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, and this is an important point, because when we get to the third session, a lot of our conversation is going to be about, you know, specific experiences that we've had with our families, and that's going to help us to articulate goals, values, and preferences. And next week, we're going to get more specific into your question. That is the focus. What we normally say, the typical approach at this point is that when we have transitioned from doing everything we can to prolong life to allowing the natural dying process and not prolonging suffering the dying process is that we say we do not do medical interventions anymore, but we still provide routine supportive care, whether that's oxygen, nutrition, hydration, just the basics. And then we'll go to you next, Rena. Nutrition, there is a little bit of nuance and gray area in terms of nutrition. So the idea with the nutrition is normally that if someone is dying from natural causes, we'd rather them die from those natural causes than from starvation. So usually Jewish law says we provide nutrition, hydration. However, there are many times when that's contraindicated, first of all, where the nutrition hydration actually contributes to the suffering that we don't want to be prolonging. Either it's not being absorbed, or it's causing aspiration, choking, and infections. There could be times when it's actually very detrimental. And unfortunately, there are some people who think that, no, Judaism requires nutrition, hydration always, at all costs, and that's not true. If it has negative indications, then not only do we not require it, we would say not to provide it. Even according to those who encourage nutrition hydration at all costs, even they will agree, though, upon, you know, if you look into their writings and the discussions, that it does not necessarily mean aggressive, invasive forms of nutrition hydration. Sometimes it can be very basic, like subcutaneous hydration, just enough to give a person kind of the basic nutrition, but not enough that, because oftentimes the truth is, at the end of life, people don't really need very many calories. And giving them too much is not in their best interest. So sometimes giving a little bit, just kind of hopefully help provide some basic support, can be beneficial. There are times, and there are rabbis who agree that there are times when, you know what, even though it's not contraindicated, but it's prolonging the dying process. And we just said we don't want to prolong the dying process. There are some times where some rabbis do allow withdrawal. Actually, they don't allow, the way they'd word it is withholding. And we're going to get this into this more next week, but what some of those rabbis say is, you know, because if you saw, if you look closely when we read that source where it said that you can stop the woodchopper from chopping, the way the rabbis understood that is you can withhold interventions but not withdraw them. But it's not a problem because even with hydration and nutrition, what they say about that is, okay, so we don't necessarily withdraw it, but you can allow the bag, the IV bag, to run out and then not refill it. That's considered withholding, not withdrawing. And there are those who allow that in certain situations. That's what we take on in a case-by-case situation, but it can be permissible. And it's a very nuanced, complicated area, so I'm glad you brought it up because it's important. And we are going to go into it more specifically next week, but then in particular the following week. And by the way, that third week in particular, although I welcome it in all of our conversations, but that third week in particular, your own stories and experiences will be especially crucial because we'll want to be discussing, analyzing our own experiences and how we conceptualize a good death, because we're going to be talking about that and our own experiences will be crucial for that conversation.
You have to make some split decisions. This is no time to call the rabbi or anybody else.
Right.
Rabbi,
you bring up a good point. You do bring up a very important point. And by the way, that's why this is so important. And I'm so impressed that you all are having sessions like this, because sometimes...
Just a minute. Could you talk a little slower? You talk awfully fast.
Sure. Yes.
I want to catch it.
Thank you. Absolutely. But this is why, you know, sessions like this they're having right now and for the next couple of weeks are so important, because sometimes you have to make split-second decisions in life that are very difficult. And if you prepare in advance and think about it, you'll have at least some, they'll still be difficult, right? They're still hard. But at least you'll have had some thought about it. And that's why, in particular, the third session that we're going to have, where we fill out our advanced directives, the goal of that is to facilitate conversations. Because what we really want people to do is talk about these issues so that when they have to make those decisions, and they actually face this in real life, they'll have thought about it. The document that we produce, that's great. That's nice. Because oftentimes you do have time, right? Sometimes it's a split second. Sometimes you have time. When you have time to consult with documents, consult with rabbis, so it's great to have it written down, and it's a great resource. When you don't have time, hopefully you've at least had the conversations that can help guide you in these difficult situations. I've been with people many times here in the hospital where they've regretted. They've said, oh, we have to make a decision right now, split second. We don't have any time to consult. And they regretted the fact that they always avoided having these difficult conversations with their loved ones. They always felt that they knew that they probably should talk about it, but it's hard to have these conversations. So you'll have an excuse now. You'll say, look, we attended this session and the rabbi gave us this document to fill out. And this document is intended to kind of induce people to have conversations. And it can hopefully facilitate that. Because you're right, sometimes it is split second. And that's what can help us the most in making those decisions, is, you know, at least having thought about it at some point in our lives. So I appreciate you bringing that up in that story.
Because you were under pressure, right, and you knew that you made the right decision, yet you might have doubts.
Yes.
Well, what if?
Right.
I mean, in this case, I'm sure it didn't make any difference, but there are always doubts after when you make decisions of this magnitude.
Yeah, yeah.
That you have to be a little bit assured that you made the right decision.
Right. And Rena, that's why I think I so appreciate your comments, and why it's so important that, and so beautiful that you attend sessions like this, because I feel like once people have thought about what does their tradition say, and they consult with their rabbis, and you know, that's why it's great. You have your spiritual leadership here. Like, there is a lot of guilt in end-of-life decision-making. And the more that one can consult with their tradition and their spiritual leadership, I also find it mitigates that guilt a lot, because you can feel like, okay, you know what? We made a hard decision, but at least I feel like my tradition is behind me. It helps to know that it wasn't all on my shoulders, but it's part of our tradition, part of Judaism, that helps to guide us in these decisions and mitigate some of that guilt.
Well,